Nature as the Classroom. In 2005, the book by journalist Richard Louvre, Last Child in the Woods, started a movement. In the book, Louvre coined the phrase nature deficit disorder and advocated for getting kids outdoors more, connected to nature and learning from nature. He argued that American childhood had become too standardized, structured, and technology-driven. In the years since, more and more schools have been incorporating nature into their curriculums, including here in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Richard Louvre is in Portland today for a speaking event and joins us in our studio. We'll talk with him and two local advocates for nature-based education. What do we know about what kind and how much nature-based education is beneficial? Is it really a practical solution for all schools? Maine Calling is next, but first, news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Sitting inside a classroom, reading or listening to the teacher has long been part of a child's education, but a new movement says that's not enough, that a critical missing element is being outdoors, exploring nature. Today, we'll learn about efforts to include nature in every student's learning. Joining me in the studio, Richard Louvre. He is a journalist and the author of 10 books, including his landmark book, Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. He is also co-founder of the nonprofit Children and Nature Network. Olivia Grissett is executive director of the Maine Environmental Education Association and is a former life science teacher in Maine. And Nathan Broaddus is manager of the Nature-Based Education Consortium and policy analyst with the University of Southern Maine's Cutler Institute. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you think about the concept of using nature as the classroom? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you, and thank you so much for being here today. Richard Louvre, it's been 14 years now since your book, Last Child in the Woods, was really a wake-up call about the need to keep kids in touch with nature. What have we learned in those 14 years? What has changed since you did that original research and wrote that book?
One of the things that's changed is the research. When I wrote Last Child in the Woods, I think I cited about 60 studies that I could find. And it seemed like it was fewer, but there were about 60 studies in the book. That it was incredibly small number of studies on something this large, how nature experience affects human development through not only children but as adults. The academic world had virtually ignored that issue. Today, if you go on the Children and Nature Network website, and that's the nonprofit that grew out of Last Child in the Woods, you'll see abstracts of, it's going on 1,000 studies since then. So it's now become a little bit of a growth industry. That's one of the things that's changed. Another thing that's changed is some of the barriers have gotten higher, more difficult. Like there's, you know, in Last Child in the Woods, I was actually talking about pagers that kids were carrying. Now it's all iPhones and iPads and all of that. And younger and younger age, children are using screens, or parents are putting iPhones in their hands when they're infants.
Mm-hmm.
So that's changed. Some of the other barriers have gotten better, but I think that the main thing that's changed is the folks that are in this studio now, the people out there that have really created an incredible movement to connect not only kids, but families and communities to nature.
Well, let's talk about that movement. And Olivia, I read an Atlantic Magazine article published last year that cited a 500-time increase in preschools, including nature in their curriculum. What are we seeing here in Maine, not only in preschools and elementary schools, but throughout the K-12 education? Is it that dramatic? Are we seeing that many more schools embracing nature-based curriculum?
Yeah, I think we really are. It's a really exciting time to be working in this type of education because people are really starting to see the benefits, both the socio-emotional learning benefits and also the benefits to K-12 education to be incorporating outdoor learning in the classroom. Especially in the pre-K setting, we're seeing a huge increase in nature-based programming as well as like complete immersion programming or like most of the day spend outside, which has been really exciting. And in Maine, we recently were working with the Maine Math and Science Alliance. We were just completed a census for understanding community-based education, how it's happening in schools, how it's happening in community partnerships. We've never had that data before, and that data is going to be released in December. And we're really excited to show kind of where it's happening, what are the barriers to the work, but also what are the solutions and strategies that schools are using to incorporate this powerful learning in the public education setting.
I understand you're like going through the census right now, but can you give us a preview of something you've discovered about Maine in doing this census?
Well, we had an incredible number of schools actually reply to the survey, which was really exciting. And many of the schools say that this type of learning is core to their mission. And we were actually like very pleasantly surprised by that. It's really exciting to see schools even across the socioeconomic kind of barriers that we have or like differences across our state. We're seeing incredible programming happening all across that band, or even though that's a challenge for some schools with low funding, they're still doing some really creative partnerships to do some really powerful community-based environmental learning.
All right. Well, Nathan, bringing you into the conversation here, we've touched on the benefits, but why don't you sort of tell us what we know? What obviously, it's good for one's soul, if you want to put it that way, to be outdoors. And we can understand how it's good for fitness levels and it's good for a child's understanding of science. But what are some unusual ways we're seeing benefits of a nature-based education?
So when I think about my own experience with growing up in Maine, in the outdoors, I think about really complex development, child development around decision-making, working with ecosystems and seeing myself as part of a complex ecosystem, and being able to do complex problem-solving that is really important to child development. It's a great benefit in terms of preparing youth for higher levels of school and workforce development, but also for being integrated more deeply into their own communities to develop a sense of place that is so important here in Maine. And it's something that members and participants in the Nature-Based Education Consortium really see as a long-term outcome of this work, is not just enriched personal development on the part of youth, but enriched communities as a whole, that we benefit as a society from expanding this work to the extent possible.
You know, it's so interesting. We have so many Maine Calling programs where we're doing having a conversation about what the schools, and I'm going to use a word I don't like very much, what the schools should be doing. The schools should be teaching more engineering and math. The schools should be teaching more practical skills like welding. The schools should be addressing kids' emotional needs. Richard Louvre, is there pushback? Is there pushback, especially from public schools who say, gosh, we cannot incorporate a sea change in the way that we're teaching right now? So much is being asked of us.
That's a great question, and that's an issue. But I can say, just from personal experience, when Last Child in the Woods came out, I'm on the book tour that never died, and so I've been talking about this a lot and giving a lot of speeches. And in the beginning, teachers were the worst audience. They kind of flat affect. Oh boy, one more thing I got to do. This guy's telling me about. Today, they're, I think, among the best, if not the best, audiences. And I think something's changed. I think that there's a new awareness that their health depends on this. Their happiness as teachers. There's a study in Canada that says teachers who get the kids outside don't burn out as early. Also, there's just a fatigue that was already setting in then, with No Child Left Behind, that approach to education reform, and that's now shifted to Leave No Child Inside. There's a real sense now that this is good for everybody, and the parents know it, the teachers know it, and the kids know it.
All right. I mentioned the Atlantic article that talks about preschool and kindergarten, and surely it's easier, I think, for somebody to get their heads around bringing younger children back before they have to, you know, learn a language and possibly learn an instrument and hit certain standards in math and writing and things like that. I want to ask you, Olivia, what are some ways that nature-based curriculum can be brought into the upper grades without, you know, disrupting all the other things that are being asked of schools?
Yeah, thanks for that. In my experience, I was a high school science teacher here in Maine in a small rural, low-income district. And it was incredible the types of learning that we could do in that school. We started a school garden, which was amazing. And even during study halls, I would walk to all the study halls, and I'd see the kids who were done or just had their heads down in the back, and I'd round them up, and we'd go out and work in the garden during those kind of flex times. I also did a whole bunch of teaching outside. Some of the youth in the shop class built me an outdoor classroom with the benches and everything. And I would teach. I did a whole bunch of courses that were focused on learning about nature and understanding natural phenomenon. But then I would also just teach biology outside with using, you know, whiteboards. And it was incredible to see the learning outcomes that happened when my students were outside, just kind of shifting a little bit the space and hearing the birds. And it sounds kind of interesting, but that was just like there are a lot of opportunities for us to get outside and I think incorporate interdisciplinary work between English or maybe writing poetry or art, doing art that's inspired by the nature around us. There's so many doing a lot of math. We did a whole bunch of math outside. So teachers are also thinking about working together on expeditionary learning. We have a whole bunch of really cutting edge expeditionary learning happening in Maine where schools will take a theme and then they'll kind of study that theme through all the different subject areas, and very often it incorporates being outside.
It's interesting hearing that you worked at a low-income public school because as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, some of these schools don't have the kind of resources to have a science lab that private school might or a more well-endowed public school. So instead of buying things for a lab, your lab is out the door.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the benefits of teaching in Maine is that often we have woods or water walkable from our schools. So transportation for busing is a barrier to larger expeditions, but we can often find little small green spaces near our schools where we can do a lot of really innovative programming.
What kind of research are you doing at the Cutler Institute around this?
I should clarify that I was a former
analyst. So, but what kind of research is going on here in Maine about nature-based education?
Well, I would come back to the census that's just been completed and is going through its final process with the Maine Math and Science Alliance and with the Maine Environmental Education Association. This is the kind of work, both looking at what is happening in schools, where is success occurring and with what kind of resources that will allow us to get at a deeper understanding of what further is necessary in order to ensure that every school district and every child in Maine has access to these types of opportunities. The big question for us right now is why do some youth have access to these types of learning opportunities and others don't in Maine? And getting around those types of questions, that's where the research, I think, is focusing to get us towards what can we do together to build supports that are both financial and not financial in order to lift up that work in an equitable way for all Maine students.
Richard, are there places elsewhere in the country that have adopted a widespread model of incorporating nature into the curriculum?
There are collaborations and initiatives all over the country, not only this country, China, for some reason, this has caught on. I've been in China talking about this a lot, and there's a whole new profession of nature educators there. Brazil just launched a national campaign to connect Brazil. You would think that they would not have nature deficit disorder, but people living in these huge cities, this is really big there too. So it's really, really widespread. One of the things, though, that I think that is coming next is most of the research is about the benefits of nature for people, kids in particular, has been done on green space, on effect of vegetation, essentially. Now, there's an assumption that animals are in those spaces, but there's very little research that's been done on the effect of wild animals on our psychological, physical, and spiritual health. And there's quite a bit of research on animal-assisted therapy, but not on how that wild animal, that bobcat in the backyard, affects you and the awe and wonder that comes from that. The new book that I'm now on the next leg of the next book tour is going to be out on November 5th. And the name of it is Our Wild Calling, and it's about how connecting with animals can transform our lives and save theirs. This is about our welfare, but it's also about the welfare of the animals themselves. There was a study just released by Science, journal named Science, that almost a third of birds in North America have disappeared in the last 50 years, just since 1970. More and more we're talking about this kind of extinction. I don't think we're going to deal with that or the climate emergency or any of the giant environmental issues unless we have generations with more of a sense of personal connection with those animals. And that's not transmitted through data. That's transmitted through the heart and through people having encounters that can be a few seconds or a relationship that can last a long a lifetime.
Yeah, at the same time, fewer and fewer birds. Statistics showing that bird watching is the number one hobby in America. So, you know, people clearly caring. The example you gave was birds, but there, and this is something, Olivia, that most children in Maine have that experience of maybe not the bobcat in the backyard, but the fox in the backyard and the deer in the backyard, the turkeys. Lord knows this year we've seen turkeys and geese everywhere. So it's not a big jump to take what's already a part of the children's world, but to open the door in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a huge boost to our educational opportunities here in Maine is that we do have access to wildlife all around us. Even if you're here in Deering Oaks Park, you're going to see those squirrels hopping around. And there's definitely, we shouldn't underestimate the power of a wildlife interaction in its impact emotionally. I'm building that kind of shared value and understanding of like, wow, I'm alive in this world, but there's other things that are alive here with me. And when we interact like that, it builds this kind of special connection. And it is kind of this magical moment. And I've had a lot of those as a teacher, as a parent with my family nature club. And I just think that it's a very incredible topic to be exploring for sure.
And before we go to a break, I want to just sort of throw out to all of you this, does it have to be either or to technology or nature, or can kids be logging what birds they've seen on an app on their cell phone? And does that have the same effect?
So I think we've started to see a great emergence of that kind of integration in Maine through different citizen science initiatives. There's been lots of ways that technology has been a vehicle to get youth outside to both connect with experts in the field and also to get a deeper understanding of what it is that they're looking at. And this has also been a great opportunity. I'll come back to the landscape connection. We have so many different types of environments in Maine. There's the forest environment, the mountain environment, agricultural context, there's the coast. And where youth are connecting with both organizations and community partners, where they are through these partnerships that often have a citizen science component, and through an opportunity to connect to their own community and their own backyard landscape, that leads to great benefits for Maine.
Can I say that all of those things are true, and those are great opportunities, and I'm not anti-tech. I just say that the more high-tech our lives become, the more nature we need. It's an equation. It's an issue of balance. In one of the sections in Our Wild Calling, I talk about what I call the replacements. This is the danger of this. Technological nature is the phrase for trying to replace what we consider real nature with data, with machines, with gadgets. You can now buy robot pets, robot dogs. There's people projecting into the future saying this is going to be blending of genetics of humans and animals is coming. That's a technological change. So we can take this too far. There is even in education. I was at a nature center a few months ago, and there was this wonderful nature educator there. She was wearing kind of a ranger uniform and all of that. It's a great nature center. And she said the number one attraction at the nature center was a pond that had frogs in it, and the parents would take the kids down to the pond and all of that. And she said, and I take kids down there, and we do science experiments, and we test the water, and we, you know, all of that. And all of this was geared toward the state standards, mm-hmm. education standards. And I asked her, have you ever taken the kids down and just sat and waited for the frogs to come back up to the surface and just been with the frogs, had the kids be quiet and be with those frogs? She said, oh, well, we do science experiments, and she kept doing that. And I asked her three times. The guy standing next to us told me later she could not hear that question because the tyranny of the way education is approached today, that it all has to meet certain standards, and it's all about data. It's not about the heart. It's not about this connection for which we have no name.
Mm. Well, we are talking about nature-based curriculum. We're talking with Richard Louvre, Olivia Grissett, and Nathan Broaddus. If you have questions, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. And the First Church of Christ Scientist Portland, where you can hear about a new view of God and its effect on well-being, on Friday, October 25th at 7 p.m.
Two men close to Rudy Giuliani were arrested by the FBI earlier this month. One says he was valuable to the president's personal lawyer because of his ties to Ukraine.
I just happen to be Ukrainian. I happen to speak the language. I happen to also have a lot of resources in that part of the world.
I'm Ari Shapiro, untangling how Giuliani's associates tie into the impeachment inquiry this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Are you a regular listener to Morning Edition? When you miss it, do you wish there was some way you could still hear it, even if it's not on the radio? Well, now you can if you have an Alexa smart speaker. Just say, smart speaker, please play Morning Edition. Alexa will then ask you which station you want to hear, and you, of course, will say Maine Public Radio. And then Alexa will play back the last full hour of Morning Edition. So you can hear the most recent hour of Morning Edition with Erwin Gratz until 3 o'clock each afternoon. At this point in time, this is only for Alexa smart speakers, but we'll let you know if Google Home learns how to do this. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the case for exposing children to nature throughout the course of their education. Joining me, Olivia Grissett. She is Executive Director of the Maine Environmental Education Association. Nathan Broaddus is Manager of the Nature-Based Education Consortium. And Richard Louvre is a journalist and author of many books, including Last Child in the Woods. He is the keynote speaker later today for a Maine Conservation Voters Evening for the Environment event at the University of New England in Portland. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you'd like to send an email, the email address is talk@mainepublic.org. Please make that email brief. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Calling in now is Drew Jump. She is co-founder and president of the Ecology School. Thanks for joining us, Drew.
It's great to be on the line with you, Jennifer.
Great. How does the Ecology School work with schools to integrate nature into curricula?
Well, there's a couple things. And first, I just wanted to say what an honor is to be on the line with Richard. When his book came out, Bringing Nature Deficit Disorder to a Wider Audience, really helped us in the environmental education field. In terms of the Ecology School, we're, as a residential environmental learning center, we're addressing nature deficit disorder through time rather than a 1 or 2 hour experience. When students and children and parents come to Ecology School, they get to live and learn together. And there's something earlier that Richard said about getting to the heart that I think really resonated with me, because the challenges we have, things like climate change and habitat destruction, aren't as much an intellectual challenge as a real heart challenge, like Richard says. And I think what we find at the Ecology School, that even though we grapple with climate change, we do it by taking kids outside and learning about how plants grow, learning about where food comes from, and doing that over several days and taking meals together and living and learning together. You get to the point where you laugh together. You have pleasant experiences. And I really am a big proponent of the idea that the work we're all doing together moves us forward into kind of, you know, smiling our way into the future rather than being fearful of the future moving ahead.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. That's Drew Dump. She's co-founder and president of the Ecology School. Calling us now, Asia Stephen, the lead kindergarten teacher at the Friends School in Portland. Thanks for calling in, Asia.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Forest Fridays at your school.
Yes, yeah, so I teach at the Friends School of Portland, which is a preschool through eighth grade independent school in Cumberland, Maine. And our kindergarten program a couple years ago, after many years of being a very play-based and nature-based program, decided to make the leap to really immerse ourselves in being outside for the full day. And so we do that on Fridays. And we have, we're lucky enough to be on 21 acres of woods. So we have a trail that we hike out to with a outdoor classroom, which is a platform and a canvas walled tent. And every Friday, no matter the weather, we are out there for the entire day. And so we really see that ability to build the sense of wonder and curiosity in young children. And it's a real response to the kindergartens that have iPads in classrooms and are really not outside playing as much as we feel families in Maine are looking for and that we feel is developmentally appropriate.
Well, Asia, thanks so much for calling in. Asia Stephen is a teacher at the Friends School. I'm going to start here with a message from Angela. She writes, I moved here from Massachusetts and was an environmental educator for 20 years. How can retired people who love children and have grandchildren get more involved with this? Please share some resources for people like me to get involved.
Yeah, excuse me. Yes, I think that's a great question. Definitely, I think the Maine Environmental Education Association could be a great resource to get connected to the community of educators, both in the classroom and in the community who are doing this type of work. So check out our website. As well as I know that we have a really robust land trust network here in Maine. We have almost 100 land trusts across the state. And many of those land trusts are currently really ramping up their work with the community around connecting people to nature, not just conserving land. And the Maine Land Trust Network is an excellent resource to connect with them, and they can connect you to your local land trust. There's also the Maine Master Naturalist Program that has a lot of retired folks doing work, and then they go into their communities and support this type of learning as well.
Yeah, we also have an email from Peter asking about the role of land trust. So you would encourage anybody involved with a local land trust to contact you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We work really closely between our networks. And it's a phenomenal thing to have both an environmental education network as well as a really robust land trust network working together on these concerns about connecting people to nature.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to go to Elizabeth, who's calling from Turner. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Richard, first, I was very lucky to use two of your books in a class that I was teaching at UMaine Farmington. The community health program there has a minor in outdoor education and recreation for community health. But I'd like to be so bold as to recommend, you know, how can we fit this into classrooms? Outdoor education should be right up there with the reading, sciences, math, and all of that. I would suggest we would have a better understanding of climate change and the needs of Maine if a third of their life was spent outdoors. I was lucky as a child. I was never inside in a classroom for more than 4 hours a day. And my career has been in outdoor recreation. So I think we should just run it up the flagpole and make it part of our curriculum.
Elizabeth, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Right, Richard?
Yes, and thanks. Thanks for the mention. I really appreciate it. You know, it's amazing how many people are out there that have adopted this as their central purpose in life. One of the reasons this has grown so quickly is that this is a happy cause. How many happy causes lately can you mention? I mean, this is You know, the people that work, like you guys, the people who work in this, invariably they're happy people. They may not make as much money as they might like, but they are happy people. And I think that's what you're picking up from some of the callers, too.
Elizabeth, thanks for calling. Timbernook on Facebook writes in, kids have been developing life skills through outdoor play for millennia. It's no surprise that more and more children are struggling in school. Sitting still in a classroom requires a strong base of body, mind, emotional learning, all of which happens naturally when children play outdoors with peers from preschool to middle school. Let's bring the balance back and let kids be kids. So I'm guessing my panelists agree with you entirely. But it is interesting that perhaps spending more time outdoor also makes it more possible for children to be able to sit and focus at a desk when they need to.
Yeah, I think what it comes back to is an acknowledgement that children really learn and become passionate about learning in different ways. They have really different needs, and that in order to meet the needs of a broader range of students, we need to provide these types of opportunities that many of the students who might struggle in a normal classroom context really succeed and excel and develop leadership skills and complex problem solving, and that the outdoors is a place where they can grow into themselves. And that reflects the wide diversity in ways of being outside, that in Maine, you know, we have many different environments, local environments, but lots of different partner organizations between land trust networks, agriculture, public health. And these are all different spheres that have been separate but are now really integrating. It's been the impetus for our network to get off the ground is a desire to come together around this issue to provide a different context for our youth to learn in.
We'll go to Ethan, who's calling from Lebanon. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much for doing all the great work everyone's doing. I've really been inspired to have nature education as my life's mission. And I'm trying to start an eco arts village called FART. And I really think that art is the most important thing we need to bring into nature's classroom and highlight as part of it, because it demonstrates the why it matters, which I think y'all were talking about. And I really just believe that making objects and understanding why we need nature to support us to make a creative life, a productive life, a healthy life is really part of an interdisciplinary classroom instead of having like science one room, English another, art another. I think it all should be one thing outside.
All right. Thanks, Ethan.
One of the things that I've wanted to see happen for a long time with the Children and Nature Network, which is the nonprofit that grew out of Last Child, is I'd like to see a natural artist network, artists that connect people to nature, not only kids, but adults as well. I think there's a lot of interest out there, but there's not a lot of ability to connect with other artists in order to do that. One of the things that you can do to encourage that is join the Children and Nature Network, which is childrenandnature.org. If you go there and join there, and I hope a lot of artists sign up and maybe collectively make that happen.
All right. We'll go to Melanie calling from Portland. Hi, Melanie. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm so excited about this topic, and I wanted to call and share my experience of having my kids at a school that makes the outdoors sort of part of the learning experience. My kids go to Breakwater School in Portland, and they're outdoors constantly. My son just got back from a trip to the White Mountains where they hiked for 4 miles. Every science class takes place outside. They even do Spanish class outside. They have outdoor classrooms for the lower schools. And I just think, I see how balanced and how peaceful and calm the kids are and how much joy they have at school and what they're learning. And it's just incredible to me that more schools aren't taking on this model.
All right, Melanie, thanks for your call.
Yeah, I just wanted to say on that, I work a lot at the national level, and Maine is seen as one of the leaders in nature-based and environmental education across this entire country. And it's because of school programs like that. It's because of so many nonprofit partners that are coming into schools and helping support teachers learning. It's because we are providing a whole bunch of professional development for teachers around getting their kids outside and how to do that well. So it's just a really exciting thing to see this movement really growing across Maine. And it's, you know, it's a significant thing for our country to watch what Maine's doing.
Thanks, Melanie, for your call. We are going to take another quick break. We're talking about nature-based education. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Peapod Jewelry, personalizing designs that commemorate your memories of autumn in Maine with family and friends. Route 1 in Edgecombe or at peapodjewelry.com.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Rachel Maddow. The MSNBC host will talk to Dan Pfeiffer about the oil and gas industry's impact on democracy worldwide, Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election, the impeachment inquiry of Donald Trump, and more. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. Did you know that approximately 120 million Americans do not have a proper estate plan? An estate plan is not limited to matters of money and inheritance. It can also guide your future health decisions and provide special instructions for loved ones in your care. This week is National Estate Planning Awareness Week. You should, of course, always consult with your financial or estate planning advisor to make your arrangements. To assist, Maine Public also has a limited supply of free personal estate planning guides. To obtain yours, visit mainepublic.org and click on support. We have a limited supply of these free guides, so contact us today.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about efforts to connect kids with nature through curricula. Joining me, Nathan Broaddus with the Nature-Based Education Consortium, Olivia Grissett with the Maine Environmental Education Association, and Richard Louvre, author and internationally recognized expert in connecting kids and all of us to nature. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Going now to Laura, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Laura. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on. I just want to say thank you to Richard. He has been an inspiration for me and my work since Last Child in the Woods first came out. I helped found the School Ground Greening Coalition based at Portland Trails in Portland, and we have been helping schools since 2003 to transform their outdoor environments to provide connections for children to nature. And I know that the show is focused on curriculum, and I would just say that for very young children, the environment is the third teacher, meaning they learn from what is actually in the environment. And so I'm curious what Richard might say about just how important it is for very young children to interact with nature in their environment, and how this might be connected to equity. In other words, making sure that all kids have access to that, not just those whose families are able to take them somewhere.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's an incredibly important issue, the whole equity issue. Two things on that. People assume rural areas have less nature deficit disorder than urban areas, and it's actually not true. The studies have shown, for instance, on animals, I've reported in this new book a study on animals, how rural kids view animals, wild animals, compared to how urban kids. Both of them focus on charismatic elephants and tigers and other on other continents, and both of those groups know very little about the animals in their own bioregions, whether they're urban or whether they're rural. To a large extent, much of the progress has been made among upper middle class and middle class people and kids. That's good. But we have to focus on so many of the kids, whether it's rural areas or urban areas, who are just not on the charts and on this issue and need to have that nature in their life for their own cognitive development, their own mental health, as much as in every kid, and also the kids with disabilities. That's another equity issue. I wrote a piece that was the cover piece in Sierra Magazine a few months ago about the human right to nature. I've been arguing that this should be considered a human right, that until it's considered at that level, it'll be patronized. It'll be seen as a nice to have, not a have to have. If all of this research that's come forth that all points in the same direction is true, these 1,000 studies, then this is part of our humanity. This is part of who we are. And to deny that part of their humanity to children because of where they live or their ethnic background or their ability or disabilities is simply wrong. We have to see this as a human right.
Laura, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Stanley in Portland. Hi, Stanley. Go ahead. Stanley, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry, I was taking you off speakerphone, Jennifer. So thank you so much for doing this program. I just wanted to call in and have a sort of a general question for your panelists. And it actually relates to Laura's comments about making sure that these resources are available to all children, regardless of geography and income. So my question is about whether any of your panelists are familiar with Maine Outdoor School and the work that they do in Down East Maine, specifically their Mono and Mono program, which specifically serves the children of migrant workers in the Down East area.
Okay.
And I'll get offline.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Actually, the Blueberry Harvest School for Mono and Mono was one of MIA's programs of the year. We recognized them for their work a couple years ago. And the Maine Outdoor School, Hazel Stark sits on our board of directors. And I just wanted to come back to that equity point again. We're working really hard at Maine Environmental Ed Association to think about equity and inclusion and to really transform this sector around equity and provide a lot of training around cultural competent education. And also we're running a new statewide network called the Maine Environmental Changemakers Network. It's youth-led, and it really focuses on bringing youth who are passionate from all across Maine, connecting them with each other, connecting them with mentors and resources to do this work, and to really train a super diverse cohort of young leaders who are going to come up and run these organizations doing environmental education and conservation work in Maine. So we're really excited about connecting all youth to these opportunities.
And at the same time, I think that there is work that we can all do, both as individuals and as organizations, to advocate on a broader level for more shared support, whether it's financial or otherwise, of this type of education in our schools and in informal settings as well. You know, I think that that's the centerpiece of what the Nature-Based Education Consortium is doing. It's the reason why so many different multi-sector, both in education, land trust network, and others who have come together to address that question of what can we do to ensure that every student in Maine receives access and opportunity to engage in this type of education, regardless of what family they were born into or what district they live in. So I would encourage listeners to visit our website at nbeconsortium.com and sign up. There will be ways to engage in a process of more outward advocacy to lift up this type of work.
Sure, and we'll have links to all three organizations on our website as well. We're going now to Ann Steyer. She's the founder and director of Juniper Hill School. Thanks for calling in, Ann. Nice to hear from you again.
Hi, Jennifer. Nice to hear your voice.
At your school, the focus is on place-based education. Is that more than just having nature be part of the school day?
It's all and then some. So I'm sure all of your panelists are very familiar with place-based education, but it really is about using the local community for the platform for integrated curriculum right through pre-kindergarten through fifth grade is what we serve at the school, in addition to free forest play groups on Thursdays and Fridays for the community. So it's all around us is the natural world, whether it's slugs crawling up the side of a building in an urban park, or it is the dirt right outside in a garden plot, or it's the 40 acres of Juniper Hill School. All of the above can be used for place-based and nature-based teaching.
And how can elements of what you do you believe, be carried out in other schools?
So thank you for that question. I think there's just your panelists know this better than I do, and those two wonderful humans in Maine, Nathan and Olivia, I know them both and doing just incredible work. We're very, very lucky. I would say that Juniper Hill School in and of itself started in 2011 as a model for a lot of schools across this state already. We have hundreds of visitors to the school as education observers throughout Maine. They come from all over, from the county all the way down to southern Maine and in between, to see what we're doing so they can bring bring elements of that back to their schools, and then I will consult with those schools to work with them. I believe it's way better to do from the inside out. It's not about that we have something to teach and bring it to them, but that there's already elements happening in so many schools that can just be highlighted and brought out and integrated across the curriculum. There's just so much work, I think, in this, and passion, like Richard was saying, one of my absolute mentors, who I finally will get to meet tomorrow. I'm thrilled. But I think that there's just the heart piece of this all, and the happiness and the passion behind this is really, really evident among the teachers that I work with. Public school teachers come to Juniper Hill for our trainings in the summer. I teach for Antioch University, another incredible close by New Hampshire resource for all of this work. Conferences that Antioch runs. We have an In Bloom conference on April 18th in 2020 that's been running for now 9 years. And that conference we're lucky to have in Maine that draws people from all over the state for workshops and such. And that is the majority of those teachers are public school teachers. So in talking about access and watching that change over the last 8.5 years of the school, we're blessed to watch this movement really expand. So bringing that in, I think that there are resources throughout Maine. MIA is one of them. The Nature-Based Consortium is another. Antioch's work, the Inside Outside organization that grew out of a regional chapter at Antioch, has three main chapters, and those are growing. So I think any of those resources can be really helpful to schools and for diversity, access, and inclusion.
Well, thank you so much, Anne. That's Anne Stiers, the director of Juniper Hill School. Deej writes on Facebook, as a third grade teacher, I was telling kids about my childhood and how I spent the majority of my non-school time in the woods. They looked at me in awe, as if this were a fantasy. I could not believe that in rural Maine, the kids had not had that same wonderful opportunity. This has to change. Is the reason that kids are not getting out, especially in rural places, Richard, is it only technology, or is it also just the modern lifestyle that there's not a parent at home on the farm or in the kitchen saying to the kids, go outside all day? Instead, both parents are somewhere else at work and want to have their children be safe and are worried about them running free without supervision.
It was a great statement that she made and a great question. A lot of times when reporters want to write about this, they'll call me and they'll want to pin it on iPhones and video games. And yes, to a degree, that's a big part of why this is happening and has been happening. But it's other things too. For instance, in cities, it's bad urban design. Where people get preached to, go take a walk. Walk where in some of these cities? You'll run into a freeway. But also the changes in our in education, the devaluing of education, of nature in education that happened for quite a while, not only devaluing nature, but ending recess at grade schools around the country has happened in huge numbers. But also the fear that parents have, the fear of strangers, which transforms into fear of nature itself. Fear of nature ticks is a real issue, and kids need to be educated about that. I learned today about there's a school that has a tick museum or a tick lab, I think. But the kids, they have bottles of the ticks at their different stages of life.
And it's a
lifespan.
Serious concern that didn't exist 20 years ago. Yeah,
I agree. But I love that idea of the tick lab where the kids learn about it. And there are things that can be done about ticks. But I think this fear over scheduling. But one of the main things that parents have forgotten how good this is for themselves, adults, and the rise of animal-assisted therapy is one of the things that's happening to change minds about that. We need the rest of nature. One of the number one issues, health issues, in the world right now is loneliness. The World Health Organization, other groups, health groups are saying that this is about to outreach obesity as a cause of mortality. A loneliness. I think that this is built on a deeper, rooted in a deeper loneliness, which in the new book I call species loneliness. We are desperate not to feel alone in the universe. There's no accident there are more dogs today than ever before in America. There's no accident that the urban parks that have the best psychological impact on human beings are the ones with the highest biodiversity. We don't want to be alone in the universe. And I think we need to act on that.
Tad writes on email, it's all well and good to have adult leaders taking children into nature, but how many kids are spontaneously getting out and interacting with it on their own terms without adults present? I'd like to see kids roaming around on their own and having their own experiences rather than ones that are set up for them. And Richard, I suspect you agree with Tad.
I agree. But, you know, one of the ironies of this whole issue is that because of all the barriers we just talked about, in order to have some kind of unstructured experience in nature, a lot of kids are going to have it structured. We're going to have to organize a lot of it.
You have to take them somewhere.
Yeah. And one of the things that's happened, you know, we have to learn to connect to nature in new ways, given those realities of that fear. And you belong to a family nature club. And I think that's one of the ways we've been promoting those. There's a family nature club in San Diego that has between 2,000 and 3,000 families as members. And so these members, not all of them at once, but three or four families at a time will say, we want to go for a walk, a hike next Sunday. Who wants to join us? One of the things that happens on those group adventures of families is that the kids, if the parents just take the kids, the kids tend to cling to the parents, want to get back to the car and the Nintendo or the video game or whatever. But when they go with multiple families, the kids are off doing things that they did for millennia. They're playing hide and seek. They're exploring the weeds at the edge of the park. So that is a kind of spontaneity that is unexpected when the family nature clubs get together and go on these adventures.
We're almost out of time, but I'll end with this quote from Monique on Facebook. She writes, I'm so happy to hear about the expansion of fostering nature connections with children of all ages in schools, not just pre-K. I worked with a teacher friend to develop nature activities for her middle school resource class, and it was a success. The teens loved it. Sometimes all it takes is one role model or one experience to spark a lifelong love of nature. And this, I think, goes back to one of the comments we had at the very beginning of the program. People out there who would like to make a difference. One doesn't need to have a degree in education or in science to make a difference, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And our Family Nature Club, we are just like self-organizing parents in our community. And one of our most amazing educators, if you will, is someone who was like, I'm a doctor or I don't have any understanding of how to do this. And we're like, let's just show up and let's learn together. And, you know, anyone can do it. I think it's us getting outside. It's us role modeling. It's us. Let's go for a hike together. Let's go do this together. We all have the power to connect to nature.
Well, thank you all. Oh, really quickly, thanks, Richard.
Yeah, Maine actually is the launch of Our Wild Calling, the new book. This is the first time the book will be physically available tonight at the event, but also tomorrow in Falmouth at the Maine Audubon at between 9 and 11. I'll be signing
9-11 Maine Audubon. Wonderful. Yep. And we'll post information on our Facebook page and our website, as well as if you'd like to know how to get to see Richard Louvre, journalist, author, speaker, doing a few events here in Maine. His most recent book, Our Wild Calling. Olivia Grissette, Executive Director of the Maine Environmental Education Association, and Nathan Broaddus at the Nature-Based Education Consortium. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.